Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Congress is back in session and the madness is mounting. Marjorie Taylor Greene is again threatening to oust Speaker Mike Johnson as Johnson considers advancing the Ukraine supplemental. And he's heading down to Florida to lobby former President Trump to support the measure. A prominent Republican lawmaker warns his caucus is being infected by Moscow's propaganda as GOP lawmakers at Trump's urging block the renewal of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or at least a key procedural vote in that direction. Russia is gaining ground as Ukraine runs out of ammunition and people. A landmark meeting in Washington among U.S., Japanese, and Filipino leaders. And a week after an Israeli strike in Syria killed top Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps leaders, Israel is on alert for Iran's possible response. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Hurston of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security, and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the Transatlantic Alliance, joining us from Paris, where he's doing a stint at one of Europe's and indeed France's finest institutions, Sciences Po, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. Everybody, welcome back to the program. It wouldn't be Friday unless Friday morning, certainly, if we weren't convening. And before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Michael, Congress is back in session. Hearings are underway, and so is the madness. We'll be getting to the hearings and other stuff in just a moment. But first, start us off with the revolts that are brewing. Marjorie Taylor Greene is again threatening Speaker Johnson's speakership. Second, Trump opposed FISA renewal, legislation that's been critical and foundational to fighting terrorism at home and abroad. That was blocked on a procedural vote by GOP members. The possible good news is that Mike Johnson is working to advance the Ukraine supplemental and is heading down to Florida to lobby Trump, even if he is participating in an election denial event. And then we've got impeachment and a whole bunch of other craziness that's brewing in the background that you'll bring us up to speed on. Anyway, walk us through all of this and where we stand and where we're going.
No, you're right. And in your intro, you said, you know, the madness continues and no truer words have never been spoken. So look, earlier this week on Wednesday, the Republicans tried for the third time to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, in which allows the government to spy on foreigners located abroad, but that surveillance also sweeps in their communications with any Americans with whom they are in contact with. And again, they failed for the third time. And the failure really came because Donald Trump had sent out a message on Truth Social on Wednesday saying, in all caps, kill FISA. So 19 House Republicans joined with Democrats in voting against the rule, which would allow the debate and the legislation to proceed. Now, I did talk to several Democrats who said they actually would have given their votes on the rule because they understand the importance of reauthorizing FISA. One, if they were asked for it, and two, embedded in the rule was a resolution bashing President Biden over Israel, opposing his efforts to place one-sided pressure on Israel with respect to Gaza, and also another resolution denouncing Biden's the administration on their immigration policies. So the law is set to expire on April 19th. After that failure Wednesday, Johnson did say, look, we're going to regroup, figure out another plan, because he knows that this is too important to national security. And Trump's opposition really seems to come from his own personal irritation rather than any logic or reason, because the provision that he's objecting to has nothing to do with his irritation. He's upset about the wiretapping of his former campaign advisor, Carter Page, during the 2016 election, and it really has no connection to Section 702 at all. So the rule that failed and legislation that would have been considered would have been a five-year extension on FISA. So now they've regrouped as of last night and earlier today, and the Rules Committee has just passed a new rule, which also includes these resolutions bashing Biden, but it also is a two-year extension, which they've now gotten Trump on board with because it would now expire during a possible Trump presidency and would give Trump the ability to rewrite FISA. So stay tuned. The Senate is very unhappy with this, but they're going to have no choice but to swallow it since it does expire on April 19th. Now, you mentioned Ukraine supplemental. Look, those talks continue. Everybody is expecting something to be on the floor next week, but we just don't know what that is. No legislation has been released yet. We do know, however, the Republicans have announced next week that they will be voting on the Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act, the Liberty and Laundry Act, the Clothes Dryer Reliability Act, the Refrigerator Freedom Act, and Affordable Air Conditioning Act. Very important things while Ukraine continues to run out of ammunition and now also is running short of air defense missiles. So talks continue about maybe bifurcating the package into a Ukraine package and an Israel package. Talk continues about making things a loan, confiscating Russian assets to use for Ukraine, and of course, lifting Biden's moratorium on liquefied natural gas exports, which you know a lot of Republicans are pretty hot about because you know the U.S. was the world's largest LNG exporter last year. And you know the administration put this moratorium on it, saying they need to assess the effects of sending so much gas abroad has on global warming. And it comes really, according to Republicans, at a perilous time for U.S. allies who are importing more LNG to replace Russian gas. So they feel there really is a nexus here. Now, the plan that has been coming together has not been reported in the press. Has been to put the Senate bill on the floor, because it really is becoming more and more of a recognition that that's really the only game in town. And that's a bill that probably couldn't even pass the Senate today. And then a separate piece of legislation attached to it that would include the loans, the Repo Act, possibly LNG, other things, with a commitment from the Senate that they would take it up. So if this does pass the House, it would then go to the president for signature. The sidecar, so-called sidecar, would then go to the Senate. They would take it up. Maybe it passes, maybe it doesn't. Now, Johnson is going down to Mar-a-Lago today after the FISA vote, which will pass. But this is Johnson's idea to go to Florida. This is not Trump summoning him. This is not Trump inviting him. Okay. This is Johnson's idea, right? Now, look, I think the press conference is silly, right? Because the press conference they're holding is going to talk about creating legislation to prevent non-citizens from voting in federal elections. But non-citizens already are barred from voting in federal elections, correct, right? But Johnson, I believe, is going to lobby Trump. Trump, I don't, is not going to lobby Johnson on Ukraine. I think Johnson is going to lobby Trump to say, we have to do this and why we have to do it. Now, Johnson got his way on FISA for the most part. He knew it was important and he kept his head down and got it done. My understanding is that Trump does not want a motion to vacate. He does not support what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing and has told her so. And she sent out a 5-page, you know, insane letter to all her colleagues with all her arguments and has drawn lines on Ukraine and FISA, complaining that, you know, Mike Johnson passed CRs. He's been working with the Democrats in creating a uniparty. He expelled George Santos. But I still remain cautiously optimistic that something is going to get done. Now, they may end up putting something on the floor next week that can't pass. It may not pass the Senate and have to show that they have to fail first before they get to the Senate bill. But I think we're still headed in that direction.
I want to get to hearings in 2025 budget deliberations in a second. But first, I want to talk about Mike Turner's comments. The House Intelligence Committee chairman, has to his credit, Mike is one of the most articulate members of Congress, and certainly passionate about NATO, passionate about his support for Ukraine, and is now warning that his party is being infected by Russian propaganda. It's a true watershed moment, right? Because he has always been a stalwart Trump supporter. He's also a strong NATO, worldwide alliances supporter, as well as a supporter of a muscular global U.S. foreign policy. It's the right call, but is it too late, Michael? I mean, at this point, because the party went from sort of right at first, it was just, talking crazy, then it was acting crazy. And now, unfortunately, right, you and I share interactions where it's actually being crazy, right? Is this likely to have any impact, especially given who it's coming from?
I think it does, right? Mike Turner continues to show a lot of courage. And remember, Mike Turner, as chairman of the Intelligence Committee, does so at the leisure of the Speaker. The Speaker decides on his own who is the chairman of that committee. But Mike is not alone, right? They talked about the three Mikes. You have Mike Turner, who chairs Intelligence, Mike McCaul, who chairs Foreign Affairs, and Mike Rogers, who chairs Armed Services. And they are all in lockstep that we need to get this done. And they are lobbying their colleagues in support of this and working with their colleagues on the other side of the aisle as well. Look, I think Turner is right. You and I have talked about this before, that the party is being infected by this pro-Russian propaganda. But it's also because Fox News, Newsmax, and OAN are infected by it. I mean, they have their own, you know, their own correspondents or former correspondents like Tucker Carlson, you know, heading over and doing Putin's bidding like a useful idiot. And then the base sees this. And we've, like you said before, it's hard to blame these people in the hinterlands because this is where they're getting their information from. They don't know any better. And they're purposely being lied to by people who know the truth at the end of the day. But a lot of this is also to appease Trump because this is personal. I mean, I'm mocking Republicans a lot lately saying you've adopted Obama's foreign policy, right? Obama is the one who wanted to do the pivot to Asia while Maduro came to power in Venezuela. ISIS ran rampant in the Middle East, and then Russia took Crimea, and he's the one who didn't want to give lethal aid to Ukraine, right? It was the Republicans that said we need to give it. And the reason that we're not giving lethal aid to Ukraine is all personal with Trump because he's upset with Zelensky because he wouldn't investigate Hunter Biden. So I think despite this, and we continue to be headed down a bad path, I do think Ukraine aid is going to get done. This is a question of if Trump gets reelected, I don't see Ukraine continuing to get funding beyond this package, and the Europeans are going to have to figure out how to pick up the slack, and that's going to be almost impossible.
We'll get to that in just a second. Where do we stand on 2025 deliberations, and what's the impact of, you know, I mean, we still have the Biden impeachment thing going. We still have the Mayorkas impeachment going. You know, how does all of this affect everything, and what are your expectations in 25?
So right now, so my expectations are that FISA will get done today. I think Ukraine eventually, this package with Ukraine, Israel, INDOPACOM will get done. And that's it for the rest of the year, right? We will see some things pass the House, some things pass the Senate, but nothing else is going to be conferenced, signed into law, and sent to the president for signature. But the FY25 process is well underway. We have a new chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Tom Cole. He just took over 2 days ago from the steering committee, unanimously put him in that post. He sent out guidance yesterday to move the process forward. And the same thing, you know, as you mentioned, hearings are well underway. The House Armed Services Committee has scheduled the markup of their bill for May 22nd. The Senate Armed Services Committee scheduled the markup of their bill for June 12th. Now, as you know, Biden's budget request does keep pace with the budget cap. So it's only 1% growth at $895 billion. Now, Roger Wicker has come out saying he wants to significantly increase it. He doesn't feel that the limits posed by the debt deal can handle the problems we have with recruiting, industrial base, acquisition, ship maintenance. And he's pointing out that China is increasing their defense budget by 7.2%. We mentioned Mike Rogers a couple weeks ago says he wants a threat-based budget, so he wants a higher top line. His committee released yesterday a military quality of life panel report, which also is going to suggest spending more money on quality of life improvements like childcare, pay, healthcare, better housing. All those things are going to cost money. So, I mean, that debate, I encourage it. I hope we can see it, but I think it's going to be very difficult for them to overcome, especially in light of the fact now that you see the president figuring out a way around the Supreme Court to forgive more student loan debt. And the dollar figures I've seen so far already erase all the savings from the Fiscal Responsibility Act. So I think it'll be very difficult to get additional defense spending, but we still have a long way to go. Impeachment continues to be a sideshow. I think the Biden impeachment is still going nowhere. The Mayorkas impeachment, they were supposed to send the articles over to the Senate last week. They were asked not to and to wait until this week by the many Senate Republicans who want to see a trial. So now Johnson will send them over early next week. 44 senators sent a letter to Schumer demanding a trial, but very noticeable. Five Republican senators did not sign that letter. So we do expect when those articles sent over, yes, they'll have to be sworn as jurors, but we do expect a motion to table this and make this go away very quickly.
It certainly is astonishing. I think when it comes to student loans, you know, you have to just stop banks from doing predatory loans and set standards so that, you know, you don't have, you know, that the loans are not bankrupting when you take them or under highly punitive terms, as opposed to necessarily forgiving all of those loans at the end of the day. There are other meaningful changes you can do. And I was at the USO's gala last night, and it was really, really interesting how many folks were talking about, you know, how much more money the department basically needs to try to do this. And I thought Senator Kelly deserves a lot of credit in posture hearings to, you know, say, listen, I'm less interested in who we're going to fight than what it is we are doing to make sure we deter the fight. At the end of the day, this spending is useful to build the capabilities that prevent somebody from miscalculating at the end of the day, as opposed to deciding that they can miscalculate. And by the way, a shout out to JD Crouch and the entire team at the USO for the great works they do every single day, but also what was a wonderful evening. And I thank my host, Bell, of course, as well, who are one of the contributors to the USO. Dov, from your standpoint, right, what are the key budgetary themes that folks in our little universe have got to bear in mind as we go through this process, right? I mean, as Michael said, it's going to be a Ukraine measure, right? Whether it's in a month or 2 months or whenever, ideally, the sooner that happens, the better, given that Ukraine is really having to give back, you know, is really getting on the back foot, as we heard from General Chris Cavoli. And I'm going to turn to Jim in a minute to discuss that. What do you think are going to be the most important budgetary themes this year? And if you're Mike McCord and the leadership at the department that you're girding for, I mean, I can tell you from my conversations yesterday, it's just incessant budgetary uncertainty that was driving everybody crazy.
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, first, remember that the current supplemental request includes bulking up on our ammunition and other munitions that in effect are for our forces. I mean, remember, when we sell stuff to Ukraine or ship it to Ukraine, we backfill with more modern stuff at home. So unless this thing goes through, our military is going to be hurting a lot more than people realize. That's number one. I agree with Michael. I think it will go through. The second thing, though, Michael seems to think this is the last one. That may not be the case. And the reason I say that is that even if Trump wins, you're going to have a lame duck Congress for a couple of months. You just don't know how some of the Republicans will play at that point. You may well have a second supplemental. But after that, of course, it's over. The other big issue, and Michael talked about this, is, you know, there's vocal support from the Armed Services Committees and, by the way, Defense Appropriations folks, that they really need to raise the just bust through the debt deal. Now, the thing about all of that is that this fiscal 25 budget, the one that's been submitted, really doesn't mean very much. A budget in the last year of a presidential term invariably gets amended one way or another once a new administration is in or the administration is reelected. Now, if Trump comes in, he may well come in with a budget amendment that cuts the budget. And that would just create even more problems because Europe is simply not ready to pick up the slack. There I do agree with Michael on. Even if Biden comes back, they may still raise the budget because, again, it was Congress that passed the debt deal and Congress that can go through it and bust through it. So I wouldn't get too excited about the current fiscal 25 proposal, except for the signal it's sending to Europe and to Asia, which is instead of adding money and, for instance, take the Navy, which actually is going to have fewer ships in fiscal 25, we're cutting back. And remember also that the assumption behind the inflation assumption behind this budget is roughly 2.1%. And inflation right now is running 50% higher than that at around 3.5%. And the Fed is now wondering whether it really will do anything with interest rates other than possibly raise them. And so you've got a lot of uncertainty about this fiscal 25 budget. It's not realistic at all. And the only message it sends is one of confusion for our allies and friends.
Jim, let me bring you to messaging and Patrick, turn to you as well, right? I mean, we heard from General Chris Cavoli, the commander of U.S. European Command, who's also NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, testified that that basically Ukraine is on the ragged edge of running out of ammunition. Ukraine's normally diplomatic foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has given up being diplomatic and bluntly calling for more Patriot batteries to better defend Ukraine. The Russians are getting in, unfortunately, a lot of shots against not just the country's energy infrastructure, but Ukraine is being pressured and is starting to lose territory, territory that was very hard fought. There was a lot of blood spilled and a lot of our treasure to help them take that terrain. How dire, Jim? You know, first, I mean, what did you make of General Cavoli's testimony? Because he did cover quite a bit of ground. I mean, that was one of the highlights. But also, more importantly, as Washington dithers, how much longer is Ukraine reasonably going to hold out? Even if we start pouring arms there, they're running out of troops. The country is exhausted. It's beginning to fracture because folks don't want younger people drafted because they have a demographic problem. They didn't, you know, this is a very small generation. That you can't afford really to lose. What's the sense on the dynamics and how that's playing and how folks in Europe are talking about
it? Well, first of all, having Cavoli there was so important because I think in Washington, it really takes someone like Cavoli with four stars on his shoulder to come into town and to make these kinds of statements in front of a congressional committee. You know, politicians and pundits like all of us, you know, blathering away within the Beltway, you know, people tune us out. But it takes someone like Cavoli who comes in and says, look, this isn't a game here. You know, this isn't just petty politics and inside the Beltway stuff. There are people dying in Ukraine because of the inaction coming out of Washington. And so having him come in with the credibility that he has and saying that things are dire, he's absolutely right. We've known that. We've talked about that on this show. There's plenty of experts out there who've been saying it, but I think having Cavoli come in and say that with a grimace on his face was important for everyone to hear. Will that move the needle? I don't know. But certainly it adds to the drumbeat in the House of Representatives that this is something that is not popcorn time watching Marjorie Taylor Greene. This is people dying in Ukraine. And so in terms of how effective or if the spigot was turned on, there's a lag time, wanting more Patriots, Patriot missiles is, I'm sure that's a need, but producing those in a timely manner so that they can be delivered in time to take effect over the next couple of weeks, you know, that's not going to happen unless we take them out of stock, U.S. stock or allied stock, and replace them later. And it seems to be people are holding on to their Patriots for their own needs come what may in the next year or two. So we're in a bad place, and we're in a place that we have built ourselves with our politics here. And even if everyone did the right thing tomorrow, the Ukrainian artillerists on the front lines are not going to see that ammunition or those air defense missiles. They're not going to see them for months. And that takes us into the summer, peak fighting season. And the Russians know that, too. So the NATO summit in July in Washington is going to be split screen. I think we were talking about this last week, where on the one hand, you're going to have cake and champagne. On the other hand, you're going to see a Russian offensive and the potential of Ukraine losing territory. So this is just, we're in a bad place. It is acute.
Is there anything more creative that we can do about it? I'm going to, after Patrick weighs in, I want to go to Dove because he had a great piece on sort of NATO's naval capabilities and how they're hurting. I mean, any creative thinking at all? I mean, I think that Macron deserves credit for at least having said, look, we may need to put boots there to try to stabilize the situation at some point. Obviously, everybody has sort of poo-pooed that notion, but is there any creative thinking that helps change this vector at all? Or are we, you know, I mean, it's right, it's a three-act play and it's a tragedy, and we, you know, can we see the second and third tragic acts of this? Is that basically where we are?
Well, I'm not looking on this quite yet as a three-act tragedy. And the second act and third act, I'm not going to write those acts yet. We're still in the first act. And I'll say in terms of creativity, we do see some of that. We saw that with President Pavel there in the Czech Republic, who has done a tremendous job scouring the world for ammunition and getting that ready to be shipped out to Ukraine, funded by a lot of nations who are funding the transportation for that. But, you know, the creativity that you're seeing is on the front lines and how the Ukraine artillery forces are using the kinds of ammunition that they have. It's not just 155 millimeter. They also have Russian calibers. They also have drones. They've got cluster munitions. They've got other things that they're using. Sometimes that piece of artillery or that munition is not the type of munition you want for that particular target. So it's not optimal, but they are trying their best to work around the shortages that have been caused by the United States. So the creativity you find on the battlefield and some of the European capitals as well. But, you know, creativity doesn't win wars. Artillery does. And artillery with a lot of ammunition. And that's what we've got to focus on now.
Indeed, it is well said. Patrick, I want to go to you. We'll get to Kushida and Marcos and Biden in a moment. But first, right, Janet Yellen was in, as we discussed on the program, was in Beijing talking about economic drivers, but also warning the Chinese from supporting the Russians. And the day after she left, Xi Jinping met with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, right? Which there was some symbolism there, I suppose. I'm sure it's purely accidental in how it played out. What are the dynamics and what are we hearing from Beijing at this point? Because even though Beijing is always interested in its own interests and not necessarily with Russian interests, I don't think the two sides trust each other as far as they could throw them, given past concerns in the relationship. They're still partners of extreme convenience, right? What do we hear? What are the optics and what are some of the messaging that we ought to be aware of here in Washington?
Well, Sergei Lavrov and Wang Yi and then meeting with Xi Jinping, I mean, all trying to send the signal that this is a profoundly strong relationship and one that's backed up by an interesting essay in Foreign Affairs this week saying that by the director of the Carnegie Russia office saying this is not short term. This is a protracted relationship. We got to get used to it. We're not going to be able to divide Moscow and Beijing. It's an important argument. We can debate it. But increasingly, there's a reality to this sort of transactional relationship of Beijing and Moscow getting together. And you're right, it wasn't accidental that Lavrov was in Beijing this week, just as it wasn't accidental that former president of Taiwan, Ma Ying-jeou, was meeting with Xi Jinping as President Biden was hosting Prime Minister Kishida at the White House. So there's a counter-programming message going on to nullify what the U.S. and its allies are doing. In pushing back. And that was sort of the main message from Russia, which is we are going to push back at American influence. And by the way, we're getting geospatial intelligence, according to U.S. sources. And China's also been giving microelectronic and machines that have been used for tanks and other military hardware, so much so that Deputy Secretary of State Kirk Campbell said that Russia was very close to crossing a red line, emphasizing that point that Secretary Yellen was trying to make about propping up the Russian economy. $240 billion of bilateral sort of trade going on last year between Russia and China. So it's a very significant part of the Russian economy.
Do you think that there are more things? And if so, what are the things that Washington and its allies should be doing to make sure? I mean, because the Chinese are already helping the Russians. They're just being pretty clever about how it is they go about doing it. Some questions about whether third-party sources are playing a role in here, certainly on microelectronics and other things, the Chinese are playing a role. I mean, what are some of the things we ought to be doing with a great power who is a manufacturing center and has capabilities and is pursuing its own sovereign strategy, even if we might not like it?
Well, we need to call them out where they're clearly being hypocritical. I mean, so when Xi Jinping calls up Putin as they prepare for their own summit meeting in the next few weeks and says, look, we have to stop interference in the internal affairs of other countries. You know, hello, you're dealing with Russia, who's invaded its neighbor and is in the third year of its war against its neighbor, China. You're supporting that. So one, we call them out. Two, we just keep building our game. You know, and I think that was apparent this week in terms of the alliance diplomacy that was on display everywhere. It's a strong message and we must not undo it. And going back to your point about General Cavoli and his excellent testimony and talking about the side they can't shoot back loses. We're going to pull the rug out from under our pivot to Asia just when it's getting real if we don't also support what's needed in Europe over Ukraine, and also support and be mindful of the Middle East, and obviously fearful of a potential expansion of war with Iran.
Dov, let me just go to you because there is a NATO point you want to make. You have a piece in The Hill about NATO's creaking navies. Just give us kind of a quick sense on the magnitude of the challenge. Obviously, last week was the Navy League Sea Aerospace Conference and Trade Show, the Navy's annual flagship event, where it can message. You can argue that a lot of the shipbuilding problems and maintenance and everything else issues the Navy has are of kind of sadly of the Navy's own making, even if it points the finger sharply at its contractors. And we're going to discuss that more in full, on Monday's program. But from your perspective, what is it you see? And more importantly, what's the way out of this pickle? And Jim, you may want to weigh in on this before we go over and get the download on Kishida's big week in the United States from Patrick.
Well, there were a few incidents over the last few weeks that sort of underline the fundamental problem with NATO navies. First of all, a Danish destroyer, rather frigate, simply some of its equipment didn't work for a half hour. It couldn't fire Sea Sparrow missiles, for example, at incoming drones. And so and the Navy seems to have covered it up, their Navy, the Danish Navy. The only reason that people found out about it, apparently the commander, the skipper of the ship had sent an email out to the Ministry of Defense and the Navy saying, hey, look, these systems just weren't working. And it leaked to a Danish media outlet. And so then the defense minister fired the head of the Navy. Well, just last week, they had another problem where they couldn't deactivate a Harpoon missile during a test. And they had to close off all the airspace around their naval base because maritime space because they were afraid this thing would go off and hit something. In the meantime, the Germans have been saying that they've got problems. Apparently, a German frigate in the Red Sea fired at one of our Reapers because there was no identification, friend or foe. And the Germans admitted about the misfiring. What they didn't talk about is why there was no IFF. And the head of the German Navy has already said their problem is personnel, training the personnel, getting people and training them, and generally operations. And so the NATO navies, and Germany says it's going to spend a lot of money, but the NATO navies have not really done very much for a decade. You can't get up to speed immediately. It's very hard to recruit when you have volunteer navies, as most of them do. In fact, almost all of them do. Unless you give the volunteers more money, which then takes away from procurement. The same thing, of course, if you spend more on operations. So they've got a serious problem, not all that different from ours. But here's the catch. I mean, to the extent that we limit our budgets, particularly for naval forces, we got to rely on our allies and friends. But if our allies and friends are in the same boat and they don't want to spend more money on their navies, that gets very tricky because right now there's a war going on, a maritime war in the Black Sea. What applies to navies in Europe applies to air forces and land forces as well. There's a serious problem here. It's not clear how it's going to be solved. It's not clear how it's going to be addressed at the 75-year celebrations. It's all very nice to drink the champagne, as Jim says, but they've got to deal with some real problems.
Jim, real quick, your take on it and how it's being perceived in Europe before we go to Asia and the Mideast.
Well, I mean, Dov is exactly right. And the sad part about this, too, is that we have seen and heard stories for years about naval problems. And Dov rightly points out it's just not Navy, but it's Air Force and it's Army as well. But you hear about the Navy ones because they're very obvious. A ship is floating because its engines have stopped. Canada's had problems, UK as well. The U.S. Navy, too, by the way. I think it was Boxer or one of the U.S. ships has had some problems and had to be taken back to port. So, I mean, we've got in NATO, and NATO has known this. We have had for years problems with maintenance and operations of ships. We've heard about these things, but the money wasn't there to do the maintenance right. You know, the professionalism is there. It's the matter of the money and the personnel and the problems that come with trying to run a modern Navy or a modern armed force in a time of budget cuts and a time of demographic problems and other things that make it hard to keep a professional Navy moving. So I want to say it's not so much a professionalism problem among these navies as much as it's what politicians have done over time, starving them from with O&M monies going to other places. And then all of a sudden expecting them to surge as if they've had good maintenance all along. And so we're surging. And when you surge and you've got a past problems with logistics and past problems with maintenance and you surge, you see the problem because they become very obvious as ships are towed back or weapons don't fire. And you see the results of years of starvation in terms of budgets.
Indeed you do. And the U.S. Navy, to its credit, is investing a lot of money in the infrastructure and the people, so are its shipyards, to be able to not just build things faster, but have that also excess maintenance capacity. Because when, you know, you have a smaller fleet, it's underway more, the deployments stretch out, you miss your dock availability, and then it causes chaos on what's, you know, and then ships end up staying in the yard longer, right? I mean, it just, you know, everything's been sort of optimized a little bit too much, made more efficient than logic would dictate. Speaking about a very ready Navy that's always in impeccable shape and extraordinarily well-trained is Japan. Patrick, give us kind of an update on Kishida's big week in the United States. A lot of discussion, a lot of agreements, a lot of progress in what is really a cornerstone part of the American Indo-Pacific strategy and one of the most important allies the United States has industrially, economically, diplomatically, and more. Big progress as well in talks, not just between Washington and Tokyo, but as well also with Manila, given that President Marcos also was in town for an important three-way meeting, and progress, including on the AUKUS agreement and expanding Pillar 2 to include Japan. I mean, what a blockbuster week. Walk us through all of this and the progress that was made.
Well, indeed, speechwriters wore out the thesaurus talking about the new, first ever, unwavering, ironclad, unprecedented meeting of maritime democracies and so on. But there was real substance to it as well. It wasn't just the words. You know, there were some 70 initiatives that were being followed just in the U.S.-Japan and U.S.-Japan-Philippines trilateral meetings. And I think some of them have real serious weight in terms of the balance of power in the region. For Japan and for Prime Minister Kishida, this was normalizing Japan in a very serious step forward of kind of making that post-war identity clear that Japan is not going to sit back anymore. It's going to be a regional and global player. It's going to follow through on its 2% commitment of GDP on defense here in the next few years. It's going to add the counterstrike capability and start working even in the AUKUS context, and hence it's the announcement that they've opened up dialogue with Australia, UK, and US on Pillar 2 of advanced capabilities to try to see where they could work with Japan. And I'm assuming things like hypersonic missiles will be part of that. But it wasn't just normalizing Japan, it was also stabilizing the alliance. And you saw that both in terms of everything Prime Minister Kishida said at the White House, but also his speech to Congress. He was bucking up America, overcome your self-doubts, continue to play your global role, understand the connectivity between Ukraine and Asia. And then he was also internationalizing a collective security problem, because there are doubts about America's reliability, or at least America's not enough anymore. So build up this trilateral with the Philippines, as with Australia, as with Korea, as with India, as with, you know, the UK. All of those are three different dimensions: normalization, stabilization, internationalization of what Japan's foreign and national security policy elite want. It's basically the inheritance of Abe, and it will carry on again, as I've mentioned before, beyond Prime Minister Kishida, who we may see him again in July at the NATO summit, but we may not see him a lot after that if LDP forces a change in leadership this fall. But you know, other things that really mattered are the command and control arrangement with U.S. forces that have to intersect the new joint forces command that Japan is setting up by the end of next March. The details have not been finalized on this, but we are expected to hear more about what the U.S. is thinking by the time of the Shangri-La dialogue in the beginning of June, when Admiral Paparo may make an important announcement out in Singapore. And I think in addition to that, the discussions, as you mentioned, on AUKUS, Pillar 2, but on the trilateral with the Philippines, the fact that they're going to be doing naval and maritime and Coast Guard training, buildup and exercises. And most importantly, on for the Philippines perspective, you're seeing real capacity building. This announcement of a Luzon corridor essentially encircling Manila Bay with infrastructure, with communications, including the undersea cables that will go from the Philippines to Taiwan, but also to from Luzon to the United States. We're seeing open radio access network, ORAN, being piloted and an academy being built in the Philippines. So Japan is getting to basically roll out their secure answered for communications on top of the undersea cables. That's real important infrastructure that will help provide resilience and strength for the Philippines to stay in and contest their sovereignty and their speech in their space, their maritime space. And that was maybe again for Marcos a critically important time to put Second Thomas Shoal on the map worldwide. Right. To show that he's got solidarity behind his position and that he's building capacity, he's getting the technical capability, and he's also joining this lattice work of alliance security partnerships with Japan, but also with Australia and with other partners.
The Chinese historically tend to be pretty tin-eared and Soviet in their responses to stuff like this. How is Beijing responding over what was a very consequential week and a week directly aimed at them?
Well, some commentators have called this essentially a strategic triangle that's being set up against China's interests that is trying to block China's ability to project power into the East China Sea, South China Sea, and around the Taiwan Strait. They've been very critical of what they've called smears against their reputation and you know, predictable, reflexive kind of talking points. But there is definite concern inside Beijing that the United States and its allies and partners have set up a countervailing coalition in response to China's actions of recent years. Now, China may not make the distinction between the ability and the desire of allies to block malign action and unlawful action, like the shouldering of ships in the South China Sea, versus anything that blocks China's ability to project its power and influence. But that is still an important distinction that the allies are trying to make for Beijing, that, look, we want the dialogue. In fact, in Hawaii this past week, we saw the military maritime consultative agreement working group talks resume on 3-4 April in Honolulu. You know, there's a desire across the board for all the countries, and Japan's words We're very calibrated toward understanding that we want an engagement with China. Philippines as well wants an engagement with China. But none of these countries wants to back down in light of China's coercion, force, and threat to basically bully the region into a Sino-centric system.
Thanks very much for that, Patrick. Dove, we're going to wrap up, and unfortunately, you can only join us for a couple more minutes. Obviously, Israel's Gaza war continues. A lot of strikes also claims that Hamas, although some debate about whether the Hamas leaders that were taken out, Haniyeh's sons, were more directly involved or not, but Israel is trying to change the messaging, open up and try to get more aid in there, right? Focusing on the fact that these were targeted, intelligence-driven precision strikes. But more importantly, Israel has withdrawn forces from Gaza. to better defend against a possible attack by Iran backed proxies a week after Israel assassinated IRGC commanders in Syria. Tehran vowed revenge. This is typical regional whack-a-mole. You're poking me, I hit you, the other guy hits back, wash, rinse, repeat. But this appears to be different. Israel is in its longest ever war in Gaza as tensions with Hezbollah in the north mount. Massive amounts of the Israeli population have been displaced both from the south and from the north, which is worth saying. Where is this going in the near term, and what are the prospects for miscalculation either on the part of the Iranians or on the part of Jerusalem?
Well, first of all, it's interesting that in the south, people are actually starting to come back. In the north, they've not. And it's not clear whether the drawdowns in Gaza are to redeploy troops to the north, or whether they're there simply to protect against some kind of Iranian revenge. The Iranians have said they've vowed revenge. After all said and done, Brigadier General Mohammad Zahedi was their key man for both Lebanon and Syria, and their interlocutor with Assad. Not only was he killed in this attack on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, it was also, by the way, actually at the consulate, I understand, but his deputy was killed, General Rahimi, and five others. So the question is, what does that revenge look like? The supreme leader is nobody's fool. He's more of a politician than a theologian, actually. And so what they're calculating is it worth firing a missile at a country that has four levels of missile defenses, which Israel does, which means that the probability of a missile or several missiles getting through is probably less than 1%. But the probability of Netanyahu making good on his threat to counterattack in a big way and probably take out Iranian infrastructure, that probability is close to 100%. And so the reports are that there have been signals already to the United States from Iran. We're going to take our time. We're not going to act hastily. That actually is very much in character with Khamenei, the supreme leader. But the Israelis can't be sure. I don't think there will be an immediate attack. I don't think it'll be a missile attack. It's too risky. And the Iranians are pretty risk averse, actually. And the last thing they need is for infrastructure to be taken out or something else. I mean, an attack on Tehran maybe could kill a bunch of the mullahs. So they're not going to do that. But from the Israeli perspective, they've got to be on alert for that. They've got to be on alert for Hezbollah. They're still fighting a war in Gaza. Netanyahu is still talking about going into, Rafah. So you've got so many things going on for the Israelis. The economy is in trouble. The whole world, apart from the United States, is not supporting Israel. Canada cut off supplies. Other countries are talking about cutting off armaments. And of course, President Biden's under tremendous pressure. But I think in terms of the Iranian threat, and it is a real threat, it's probably going to be something like retaliation, possibly against Jewish institutions around the world, or Israeli tourists, or something other than this major missile attack, much less nuclear kind of attack. And by the way, the Iranians are awfully close now to having some kind of nuclear weapon. One of Mr. Trump's stupidest mistakes was to walk away from that deal, not because it was a good deal, but because at least there was some kind of deal, and now there's nothing.
Indeed, I think it would be a big mistake for the Iranians. I know that they want to do something. I know they're likely to do something. I completely agree with you. They're very risk averse and very cautious, but they'd better calibrate this very carefully, because Israel is not in the mood to put up with something that is as deadly as they would like to make it. Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, what the Iranians don't know is everybody believes that the Israelis have nuclear weapons. What the Iranians don't know is, would Netanyahu actually order a nuclear strike? If I were an Iranian general, I would be telling the supreme leader, you just can't take that chance. And
right,
that is the fundamental question in Khamenei's mind. Do I take a risk? And then the Israelis hit me with what we all believe is a nuclear weapon. And given the crazy right-wingers in Netanyahu's government, this could really be a possibility.
Yeah, and I would hope to believe that that wouldn't be the case for something as extreme, for something that is a peripheral proxy attack. I don't ever want to counsel forbearance, but alas. Everybody, thanks very much. Terrific discussion as always. Really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend, a great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week. A reminder, a very special thanks to our audience for joining us, as well as all of our sponsors for their support that makes this program possible. Check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavus Ships with Chris Cavus and Chris Cervello, sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace to clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, that takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll be back again on Sunday for the Business Roundtable. Until then, have a great weekend. Thanks very much.